there are people over at the Ringer, I mean, Sean Fennessy, people like that, that are wickedly smart and really capable. I wouldn't bet against them. And I think that, you know, Grantland had, obviously, Simmons, and but it also was launched from ESPN. So you had a lot more eyeballs and you had a bigger cannon from which you were being fired, you know, from. But I think that you're, you know, what you say parenthetically in your question is probably right, which is it's too soon to tell. But I really believe that they have enormous plans over there, you know, to like, is we used to say in business school, vertically integrate, and they're going to be getting into video and they're going to be doing shows, and you know, so it'll be very, very interesting to watch.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Alan Kim, and this week our guest is Jim Miller, James Andrew Miller, the author of Powerhouse. This is an oral history on CAA, Creative Artists Agency. Highly recommend this book. Jim, of course, has been on this podcast before. You know him very well from his best-selling books on ESPN and Saturday Night Live. And this is another one I recommend. Incredibly readable. If you, you know, CAA, basically so much of what you see in terms of content in movies, film, theater, art, and sports for sure, CAA is the invisible hand that controls this all, and or one of the invisible hands. Jim goes back to the beginning of how these guys formed their own agency and where CAA is today. Just for my podcast, for some inside baseball, I can't tell you how many people who are part of ESPN, Fox Sports 1, NBC, CBS, who are repped by CAA, the entire media industry. They're not the only game in town, but they are a big game. So many of the people that you see on television and many of the people you read or listen to on the radio, CAA represents them. So very much looking forward to Jim Miller, who is in Los Angeles on a mega media tour. It's incredible that he has given us or granted us some time in between Bill Simmons, Colin Cowherd, and some other major sports hitters. But he has come back. He is slumming Alan Kim back to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. So without any further ado, let's go to Jim Miller, author of Powerhouse, live from LA. All right, and as promised, we bring in Jim Miller. I think his formal author title is James Andrew Miller. He is in Los Angeles now promoting his new book, Powerhouse, that is an oral history on CAA. Jim Miller, of course, New York Times bestselling author on books on Saturday Night Live and ESPN. And in between doing media appearances for some of his favorites, Bill Simmons and Colin Cowherd, he's generous enough to join our little podcast at Sports Illustrated. Jim Miller, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me, I think.
Welcome back, I should say. Second appearance. All right, first off, Jim, you know, I don't know what the word would be, but I think people in terms of how you approach something literary, you have this format, which is an oral history format, which I think is very, very readable. Did you, for this particular book, think about doing a straight narrative, or for you, were you always going to follow the same theme or the sort of the same structure that you did with your ESPN book and your Saturday Night Live book?
You know, it's an interesting question. I, to be honest, I did for a moment there think about doing it as a straight narrative. One of the things that I wanted to do with CAA was kind of expose a brand rather than go deep with a brand that people already know. I mean, obviously, the initials SNL and ESPN are very iconic, so everybody knew about it. And I just thought that CAA was these initials that are not particularly well known outside of Hollywood, and it might be better to just write the book rather than use the oral history format. But at the end of the day, I came back to the oral history format because I really do believe, I mean, first of all, I happen to love it. I loved it when, you know, George Plimpton and Edie did, when George Plimpton did Edie. And I loved it for a long time. I think it is one of the best ways for readers to really, really experience what people are like in these places that I write about. And, you know, I mean, there's just no way you could have Ernest Hemingway sit down at a typewriter, and there's no way that they're going to be able to match what it was like when Billy Murray talked to me about when Gilda Radner died, or in the ESPN book, you know, numerous people talking about how they got into the business or things that happened or anything like that. And so I was a little worried, though, doing the oral history format here with CA, because they're notoriously private. They did not, you know, it was a much higher mountain to climb than ESPN even, that didn't want to cooperate. And so I thought, well, I might have to jettison it, but it kind of turned out well. I think that the thing that with the oral history, the thing that confuses people sometimes is, you know, that they're not going to get that declarative voice, meaning my voice, the writer's voice, telling them exactly what to think. You know, I had a reviewer who said, you know, misses that, you know, control that the writer has over the reader. Well, I don't really want that control. And, you know, it's an oral history, so don't go into a Japanese restaurant expecting matzo ball soup. This is what it is. And it's these people talking. And, you know, I try and obviously use journalistic principles when we're going through the periods, through the eras of the company. But I just love it too much to have given it up.
Why choose CAA, a topic about the agency business? Why choose this topic to explore?
You know, I really believe CAA was for me at least the perfect vehicle to talk about the content world, like I wanted to talk about it, because you know, SNL's a show, ESPN's a network, and CA is this kind of vast web, and now it's worldwide, that is a huge part of the content universe. And I think, again, just in terms of discovery for readers, I don't think that they realize that from the moment they wake up in the morning to when they go to bed with Jimmy Fallon at night, CA is like literally a bigger part of their lives than certainly someplace like ESPN or SNL, but more so than anything. I mean, they get in the car, they turn on Katy Perry, they watch Game of Thrones, they you know, watching J.J. Watt on the football field. Even when they go into a Chipotle, there's a CA is consulting with Chipotle. So I just thought it was a, you know, on two levels, Richard. One was, it stands at the crossroads of the whole content universe that we're trying to make sense of. And the second is that it's this, you know, iceberg that you see a little bit of, but there's a lot below the surface, and that was fun to report on.
The agency obviously represents very, very famous people, and there are very well-known people in your book, whether it's Tom Hanks or Sylvester Stallone, Jennifer Lopez. As an author, how do you go about getting people at that level, or that level of fame, I should say, Jennifer Lopez or Sylvester Stallone, to talk to you about something that's very personal to them, contracts, contractual obligations, and the business side of their fame?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I was told that, I interviewed Tom Cruise, and I was told that he had really never done extensive interviews for a book before. I mean, they're not, a lot of these don't like to do that. I think that it's funny because the previous books sometimes can be a big help, or sometimes they can hurt. You know, one famous actress told me, I'd love to talk to you, except I don't want to, because I know what happens. People wind up telling you a lot, and I don't want to be in that position. I don't want to, you know, have a conversation with you because I read one of your other books. And so in that way it can hurt, but sometimes it can help. And I think that if they were fans of the other books, or maybe, you know, read other things that I've written, or, you know, their advisors trust me, then they'll encourage them to do it. I mean, obviously, one of the things, just getting back to your earlier question for a moment, one of the things that, you really, really need the oxygen of an oral history is obviously participation. So, you know, whether it was somebody like, Tom Cruise or Dustin Hoffman or J.J. Watt or any of those other names that people talk to me for this book, you know, the first thing you wind up doing is being, you know, enormously grateful. And CA even came around and decided to participate, which was, a pretty big deal because a lot of those people had, you know, agents aren't used to talking about themselves. They're supposed to be talking about the client. So a lot of those people had never really done that before.
So let's use Cruise specifically, because that's interesting. That's not a guy who has really talked a lot about the business of Tom Cruise. He certainly talked a lot about Tom Cruise and Tom Cruise, the actor. How did you specifically go about getting him to agree to talk to you for this book?
You have to kind of study his network and the people around him. And I think that it was, you know, you just try and make your case. And obviously, his press people, and that's a important part of it, but also people who had, worked with him before. And, had lots of people lobbing in nice words on my behalf. And I must say that, he was, delightful. And it was really interesting to talk to him. I mean, he's been at CA since he was 19. So, and he's in his mid 50s now. So that's, that's his whole career. I mean, when he started out by telling me he was crashing on Sean Penn's house when he, Sean Penn's couch at, when he first came out to LA, and Sean Penn said to him, you got to talk to these guys over at CA. And, so he's been there ever since. And, he really, in the book, he talks about the experience of being at CA and why it was important to him in terms of getting exposure to Paul Newman and Martin Scorsese and Dustin Hoffman and all these other people. And so you kind of get another insight into life at CA through him.
Alan Kim, did you notice that Jim Miller did not give us one specific on who, like in terms of a name of who he used to get Tom Cruise? I'll let him off the hook there, but that's typical Jim Miller, not giving you specifics on the question that I needed. Jim?
No, it's Jim Miller being respectful.
Of course. It's Jim Miller protecting sources.
Somebody who, works with Tom, who, may not want 7,000 phone calls tomorrow.
All right, Miller, listen, if I was Bill Simmons, not only would you be giving me the name, you'd be giving me the email and the phone number as well. But all right, we'll move on. What person were you most excited to get? I remember talking to you for the ESPN book, and one of the interesting revelations that you told me, I remember, was that Tom Rinaldi, out of all your hundreds of interviews, I think was the only ESPNer that you wanted that you didn't get. So let me reverse it on this one. Who for the CAA book did you think you would never get to sit down and speak with you on the record? And then you ended up getting that person.
Look, you can't take for granted any of these people. And obviously we were just talking about Tom Cruise, who, if you're thinking about CAA, he's been one of the important clients. And I was delighted to speak to Barbara Streisand, who was, but I think in some ways, it sounds funny, but Sylvester Stallone was really important because I think the millennials have a tendency to forget that Sylvester Stallone in the, late 70s and through the 80s or early 90s, I mean, he was huge. Maybe aside from Muhammad Ali, probably one of the most recognizable people in the world. In fact, his agent, Ron Meyer, tells a story that they were out in the outskirts of, I think it was Thailand or something, shooting, looking for locations for Rambo Part Two. And there were people in this small little village yelling, "Rocky, Rocky, Rocky." I mean, when they would go to restaurants, they would have to close down half the street. And I'd always heard also that Stallone is a very reflective person. So that was a pretty big target of mine. And it turned out when I did speak with him, he was as advertised. He went into this rather emotional response to a question I had about when Ron Meyer called him up and told him he was no longer going to be his agent, and including telling me about a poem he wrote to Ron Meyer, which, you know, is not something you would associate necessarily with Sylvester Stallone. And so that was, you know, that was pretty great. And then there are people like Sarah Jessica Parker, who I'd interviewed before for the Saturday Night Live book, who I just know are great interviews and they'll be fun to do again. And interesting. I don't know. There were, I just was really captivated by some of the names that you think, well, who knows, those will be interesting. And then somebody like Nicole Kidman wound up being just incredibly thoughtful and so honest and so raw. And, you know, so it was fun.
Yeah. I think Stallone's fascinating. So I'm not surprised by that at all. He's had an amazing career. He's bright. And that part did not surprise me at all. The, Jim, just given the, logistics of this, and maybe this is just a question for me because I'm fascinated by it. How many of these did you do in person versus on the phone? Because, you know, you're talking about, you just mentioned Nicole Kidman, Tom Cruise, Sylvester Stallone, maybe a lot of them live in Los Angeles, but I think Nicole Kidman either lives in Nashville or Australia. I mean, you're talking to people, I imagine, in different cities, correct? So was this phone work or did you really do a lot of traveling for these hundreds of interviews?
I mean, my preface is always to do interviews in person. I think that there's just another level that you can, you know, that you can reach. It's not to say that a phone interview can't be good. I think that a lot of times it was logistics. There were several months where I was trying to, you know, get in touch with, you know, a couple of these people in person. And then you just all of a sudden, you know, I had deadlines and wanted to get it done and make sure I got it done. So if I find out that, well, you know what, they got, you know, 45 minutes on the phone tomorrow, I mean, I'm going to be like, let's do it. I know what they look like and let's just do it. And, you know, if it doesn't work out well on the phone, then you try and reschedule. But I think that, you know, you just got to be careful because these people are, you're not paying them to do the interview and they're not really getting anything out of it. And so if you can grab them on the phone, you know, then you do it.
Jim, one of the things that, first of all, let me preface by saying I'm biased, obviously. I'm a big fan of Jim Miller. He's a friend. I think I really enjoyed the book. I totally recommend it. You should go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or, you know, wherever you buy books and check it out. I think it's eminently readable and really interesting. That's a long preamble, Jim, to say that you got some negative reviews by the New York Times, which I want to ask you about because you have experienced both sides of the ledger. Your ESPN book was not just a bestseller, but it was at one point the number one book on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, that is an author's dream that very few people can achieve. On the downside, you've received a couple of reviews for this book from the New York Times, which have been really, really negative. And so I wonder, what is it like? What is it like to read a negative review?
Well, I mean, look, Jim Stewart's a brilliant writer, and I mean, people may know him from Disney Wars, but he writes for the New Yorker. He wrote the review, and I have to say, I think that I don't think that was a bad review at all. I mean, I think he had a couple of little, you know, digs there at the oral history format, but he was very nice to the review that I think you're mentioning is the Janet Maslin review. And look, it's not fun, but that one in particular, I mean, I kind of just started laughing at the first graph because her whole point was, you know, that I needed the, and she called it the secret sauce of Tom Shales this time out. And, you know, listen, Tom is a, you know, dear friend and, a great writer. I was pleased that he immediately went to Facebook and Twitter to say, hey, Janet Maslin, I haven't even, you know, basically read the ESPN book. I don't even know who the people are in the cover. You know, Tommy, not a big sports fan, but I decided that, you know, we kept his name on the ESPN book because we had pitched it together, and then, you know, I think he realized that was not something he wanted to do, but I just thought it was kind of hilarious because it turns out that the secret sauce to getting a good Janet Maslin review is to have Tom Shales' name on it rather than, her actually reading the book. I really didn't understand her review because I think that in many ways this was a much more difficult book to do than the ESPN book, which I loved. They're all my children. I love them. But this is a much more difficult book. These people were much more difficult to get to talk to on the record. And I think the book covers many more aspects of the entertainment business and everything. I think that she didn't see Tom's name and she's a Tom fan. So that's fine. But the short answer to your question is it's not great. I'd never gotten a review like that in my life, dating back to, when I was 25 and wrote my first book. I'd never gotten it, but you just gotta move on. But I just thought that one was particularly, it was just kind of ironic, that's all.
When that happens, do you or your agent or your publicist go back to the reviewer to say anything, or do you just move on?
I just moved. They did issue a correction, though. The New York Times had to issue a correction because I have no idea why she decided to say this, but she said, it's clear that Miller used interviews from previous books. And that's just a lie. That's just ridiculous. So the publisher did, my editor did contact the New York Times, and they are printing a correction about this. But fortunately, the main thrust of her, review was this idea that, Shales was missing from the equation. And Tommy was classy enough to immediately go on Twitter and say, excuse me, but you couldn't be, further from the truth. And I think Powerhouse is an even better book than the ESPN book. So, that was nice of him.
One last thing on that is, does the Times impact book sales? Can a negative review impact book sales? Or is it like a sports column where, there's a million different takes on Gabby Douglas, and in the end it just becomes noise? Do you think there's a direct correlation between that specific publication and book sales, or is it just another review in the sea of reviews?
The truth is, I don't actually know. I know it's not like theater. Like, if Ben Brantley doesn't like something, that's a pretty big speed bump,
right,
for a Broadway show or a play. But in this case, I don't know. I really can't tell. I think that, if it hurts sales, then, that's doubly unfortunate. Everybody's entitled to their opinion, and she wrote the review, and, I just can't sit around and dwell on it because, thankfully, getting really great feedback from other places and readers, and you just move on.
Well, how many interviews, Jim, in the end, did you do for this book? What was the number?
I think about 520.
Wow.
520, which is kind of and it's weird the way it worked out, Richard, because it wasn't like a blueprint, but it's roughly in the same neighborhood as the ESPN book. And I think that the thing with the ESPN book, though, was that I had to go back many times, there were at least, I think, 350 or 400 people, individuals. But there were people that I interviewed Chris Berman four times, I think, and, Keith and Dan many times, and other people. But it turned out about the same number of interviews.
And the last one on this is there someone that you really wanted for the Powerhouse book that you did not get? And if you didn't get them, what was the reason they gave?
So, Brian Lord is one of the partners at TA,
right,
and I have tremendous respect for him. I talked with him. He was kind enough to talk with me on background, and was very helpful and very insightful on background. When it came to being on the record in the book, he decided not to, and he told me that he had, gone through a rather prolonged process of deciding whether to do it or not. But it's totally in line with, you know, just Brian's persona. I don't think that, you know, he's not somebody that's, you know, quoted, you know, every day or for that matter, all that frequently at all. So I think that because he's really smart and thoughtful, and it's an oral history, I, of course, you know, would have loved to have had him in the book. I totally respect his position. And, you know, you can't, you know, you just can't win them all. But I was delighted to get, you know, the rest of the CA leadership all on the record.
I don't know if you want to answer this, but I do want to ask it. Do you walk away from this book liking Michael Ovitz?
Pardon me?
Do you walk away from this book and from your interviews, do you like Michael Ovitz as a person?
Do I?
Yeah.
I think that when I spent a lot of time with him over, you know, 2.5 years, and he is a very, 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 I can't even stress it enough, an unusual person. There is, he has a different way of looking at things. And I think that one of the things that I came away with is a keen understanding of like 360 degrees of Ovid. So I think that the short answer to your question is, I think that there are things that I admire about Ovid. And I think there are things that, you know, I find problematic. I was certainly captivated by him in terms of an interview subject, and I think you would be too, because he has a, first of all, he speaks in complete paragraphs. There's never an there's never a maybe, there's never a I think, or you know, or something like that. You know, I'm used to cleaning those things up, as I say in the preface to the books, because you don't want to burden the reader with any of those things. And you, when I went over Michael's interview responses, there were just none. He's very articulate, and he's very secure in his version of the world. I'm doing an interview, doing a discussion with him and Ron Meyer in Los Angeles in early September. It's actually going to be, I think, one of the first times really that they've appeared in public together in over 20 years. They had a difficult separation. And I'm very aware of the fact that this is a guy who speaks with absolute conviction of his own thoughts. And so that makes it, you know, a very, very compelling interview.
Oh, that's interesting. Where is that interview taking place? And is that open to the public for tickets or sold
it
out?
Is. It's at the Directors Guild in Hollywood. Unfortunately, it sold out, I think. There were like 650 tickets and they went pretty fast.
Well, yeah, I don't know. That's unfortunate. That's a good sign. That's pretty, that's kind of an amazing, at least in that world, that's a pretty amazing thing to, or will be a pretty amazing night to be at. All right. I want, again, the book is Powerhouse. We've mentioned it at the top. We'll mention it here. All right. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with Jim Miller right after this. All right, the Olympic Games have been giving us incredible moments. You saw Usain Bolt win the 100 back-to-back-to-back. Some incredible tennis action between Juan Martín del Potro and Andy Murray. Of course, the swimming with Phelps and Ledecky and Simone Manuel. And it's just been a great Olympics. And one of the things that Sports Illustrated has done, which has been very cool, has been a special daily podcast to keep you plugged in to everything going on in Rio. Alex Abnos and Mitch Goldish are staying up to all hours of the night to deliver fresh episodes for you for your morning commute. I was on the show a couple of days ago, really enjoyed it. And so it's worth checking back on these, even for some previous episodes, because they talked to some Olympians who have competed. And if you're an Olympics junkie, it's been a really interesting listen. These guys are really, really into the Olympics. The podcast is called Sports Illustrated at the Games. Visit si.com/Olympics for all the coverage. Before we let Jim Miller go, I do want to ask you, Jim, a couple of ESPN media-related questions, because that is, as you know, that is the reason you generally are on this podcast. It's not to promote the Jim Miller brand, but to get Jim Miller's expertise on all things media. So do you want me to start with ESPN stuff or FS1 start? What would you prefer?
I'm at your disposal.
All right. So let's start with ESPN. What do you make of them continuing to lose cable subs?
Look, it's more serious, I think, than they anticipated years ago when they were doing financial projections at, you know, probably 5 or 6 years ago. I think the numbers have caught them by surprise. Certainly, Disney kind of admitted to that in a couple calls with investors. And so just to give people perspective, which in case they don't already know it, it can wind up being serious money, because you're talking about, let's just say, on an average of $5.50 per sub, and you're talking about six or seven million households all of a sudden disappearing. That gets to be a number that is serious. And obviously, the heart of the dual revenue stream for ESPN, and the reason why they've had such a huge financial advantage over their competitors for more than 30 years, is the fact that both of those streams were alive and well. The interesting thing for me is, even with that kind of that those lower numbers and those significant dollars being lost, if you look at the NBA deal and if you look at the Big Ten deal that they did, it is still like, you know, the money is pouring in. I was really surprised by the level that they went to for the Big Ten deal, because anybody who had thought in the aftermath of some of these distribution numbers going down that ESPN was going to let its foot off the pedal and start to pull back from some major deals that they really wanted, clearly wrong. And I think that we need to keep that in mind, that as long as John Skipper is president of ESPN, he's going to be incredibly aggressive. That's not to say that he's not going to lose some things. He has. But I think that when things really, really matter to him, he has the ability to get Burbank to spend a lot of money. The only advantage that they have right now is that there's nothing big coming up now. The NBA deal is done. The Big Ten deal is done. The Pac-12 deal is done. Monday Night Football is, you know, was a long deal. So one of the things that Skipper engineered really and was a pioneer in is these longer big money deals. And it's now working to his advantage because he's got things locked up. And so if you're a competitor, there isn't a lot of property. There aren't a lot of live rights to kind of take away from ESPN right now.
Jim, you know, one of the things for them in the next couple months is, and it's going to be tricky, is Chris Berman's walking away. I don't even know how you sort of phrase it. Sort of, you know, the long goodbye to Chris Berman for that network. He's still going to be on their NFL shows. He has publicly said through his agent that he does not want to retire, yet they have made it clear that they are moving on from Chris Berman next year in terms of NFL hosting. How do you see that playing out? Because that's tricky on a number of levels. One, you have a guy who helped build the place, but who has a big ego, and you know, you want to do a proper goodbye. Two, you can't really move on and sort of start this whole new era of your NFL shows if Berman's still there. So a lot at play with that guy this year.
That's incredibly easy. I think it's incredibly easy, because what you do is you basically give him an emeritus role. And you say to him, look, if you want to still be part of the ESPN biosphere, that's great. You can do Home Run Derby, and you'll make a voiceover or do an appearance during the ESPYs. And next year during NFL, you can have a 2.5-minute video segment, or a, you know, the video equivalent of a column per se. And we will, you know, weave you into the fabric of ESPN in numerous ways. But the truth is that they've made the decision that next year there's going to be a new host to that Sunday show. And that's the decision. I mean, once you make that decision, everything else is beside the point. You know, it's not an entitlement program. And I think that they were they let him stay and they wanted him to stay as long as he has. But it's clear that now his role is going to change, and that's all. They're just going to do it.
Do you see any big talent moves at ESPN on the horizon? Whether, and you know, it doesn't even have to be a name. Do you expect them to, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me is, you know, there's all the talk about it's an exodus from ESPN and this person's leaving. But, you know, people sort of quickly forget that ESPN offered Skip Bayless $4 million to stay. So there are people who made the decision there to leave, Tirico, Bayless, Coward. They, you know, this is not the sisters of the poor. If they want to get somebody, they're clearly still going to pony up the money. So do you expect, a big talent acquisition for them? Or do you think it goes the other way and we're going to see cost cutting heading forward at ESPN for talent, except for the big talent that they really want to keep?
Well, I think, first of all, just to echo your earlier point, and I had said this and back then, I think it's weird to just kind of like have a blanket statement that ESPN is just trying to cut back on talent salaries, because as you point out, they wanted to keep Skip, and they were very, very aggressive with Bayless, trying to keep him there. I think they could have kept a couple other people, but those people wanted to leave. I mean, Colin Coward, another example. So and they spent a lot of money on Lindsay Zorniak, and they spent money on Michelle Beadle, which is not insignificant.
Right.
So I think it's really kind of missing the boat to say that they're not spending money on talent. They have lost some, but that's almost beside the point in their mind. The question, the interesting thing about your question is, moving forward, what is, particularly now with John Wildhack gone, what is ESPN's approach to talent moving forward? And P.S., is it part of the equation for helping them solve what I think is an important problem for them, which is, you know, what to do with SportsCenter? Because in a world where a lot of this information is already on your phone and not particularly proprietary, is the way out of SportsCenter to make it more personality driven, which is what they kind of tried to do with Van Pelt at late at night? But is it, you know, during the 1990s, in the early 1990s, when you had Keith and Dan on the Big Show, and you had Craig Kilborn at 2:30, and you had Robin Roberts, Bob Lee, and Charlie Steiner on the 6 o'clock show, people tuned into those shows not just because they couldn't get information on their phones, but because they really loved being with those people, just like people tune into, let's say, the Today Show, Good Morning America, or Jimmy Fallon at night. So if they're going to do that and develop those kinds of personalities, they're going to have to spend some money on that. If they want it to be just a utilitarian universe where anchors are easily interchangeable and no one has a really big profile, which means that if you lose them, it's no big deal, then that's another route to go. I just think that right now that they're kind of like straddling eras. And one of the ways in which we're going to be able to see how they're solving and how they're addressing their programming needs is the emphasis they put on talent.
It's interesting. Lindsay Zorniak, by the way, another CAA-er in the pantheon of CAA talents at ESPN.
Yeah.
All right, a couple more here. Listen, we know that you are, of course, an apologist for Colin Coward and Jamie Horowitz. I mean, that is clear.
Hold on a second. You know, Senator Moynihan used to have this axiom: everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Right.
You love journalism.
I do.
Where is the data supporting this?
You are going on Coward's show, I think, in the next couple of days, if not today. And you have always had a soft spot for Jamie Horowitz for whatever reason. Maybe I don't even know why, but you see that. And by the way, Jamie Horowitz will be the president of Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports 2. But this is my long, long preamble to say that Fox Sports 1 is going to be 3 years old. We're taping this on a Monday. This Wednesday, August 17th, Fox Sports 1 will be 3 years old. And forgetting about their rights and remote programming, their new paradigm when it comes to their day parts is that they would like to be sort of the Fox News of sports, or try to do a little bit of the Fox Newsization of sports. Jamie Horowitz believes in what he believes are differentiators, hard-edged opinions, provocateurs. You are someone who essentially wrote the book on ESPN. You're an ESPNologist. We know that SportsCenter is no longer the SportsCenter of the past, but listen, still drawing 600,000, 700,000, a million viewers. What do you think of Horowitz's paradigm where he believes that there is a void in the marketplace for a certain kind of sports opinion, which is what he is gambling on with a lot of money?
Right. Okay. Well, listen, it is a gamble. First, I can't help but just say, it's the kind of like thing that Skip Bayless has said. So if you go on somebody's show, you're an apologist for them. That's kind of like pretty funny, Richard. But anyway, right. Here's the thing. look, Jamie is making a big gamble, and he has a strategy which involves spending some real serious kinds of money. I think that one of the things that hasn't gotten some attention is that when he first got there, he canceled a couple shows that saved some money. So I think that part of what he's been doing is playing with, he hasn't been spending as much money as people might think because he saved some money. I think one of the things he canceled and probably was $15 million or something like that. But my only point is, putting that aside even, yes, Colin Cowherd, Jason Whitlock, and Skip Bayless, those are big ticket items. He's spending the money, and you know, now he's got to show the results. The one thing, and this is not being an apologist for him at all, but I'll say this. The subtext of your question actually speaks to a strategy, which is Skipper had a strategy when he became the moment that he became head of content. I mean, what he pitched George Bodenheimer to become number two on ESPN was basically, there was a 13-page memo, but the heart of it, what Skipper really wanted to do with ESPN was three initials, live. That's all he cared about.
Right.
There was a lot of original programming going on, and there was a lot of other things being developed at ESPN on the time. He said, put me as head of content, and all I care about is live, because he thought, I don't know if we launch a show and it will work. I don't know if we have a show that's working, whether it will work 3 years from now. But damn it, I know that 4 years from now, when the Rose Bowl comes on, everybody's going to want to watch it. So he went deep. He literally, the Skipper era, when people like, you know, yourself and I and others are going to be talking about the Skipper era after he leaves one day, it is absolutely defined by a very specific DNA, which is live, 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 live. Let's spend as much money to get these rights, to spend long-term deals, to have long-term deals, spend the money we need so we can keep it away from the competition. Jamie Horowitz doesn't have that kind of ability. As I was saying earlier, there aren't a lot of media rights available. He doesn't even have the wherewithal himself to go and spend that kind of money. So what he's done is he's designed a very specific strategy within the architecture of Fox Sports, where he's going to make it about, you know, proprietary personalities, these discussions that, you know, are at the basis of these shows. I think that the short answer is it's going to be very easy to tell whether it's working or not, because it's about generating numbers. And he's going to need, you know, he feels, he hasn't told me this personally, but I would assume that he feels he needs time to get that lineup right and to have it going and then to market it and to have people like Cowherd and Whitlock and Bayless pay off. But, you know, come a year from now where you can set your own timeline, if people aren't watching those people, then, you know, that's probably going to be, you know, evidence that that strategy was not working as well, you know, to the degree that he wanted and the degree that he needed after spending that money. This is, let's see, Cowherd, 5, 4. I mean, you know, we're talking, you know, lots of money, north of, close to $15 million of payroll probably that he's gone through since he took over.
First of all, I don't honestly think you're an apologist for Colin Cowherd. I'm just busting your chops. By the way, what do Cowherd, Whitlock, and Bayless have in common? Once again, CAA, same agent, in fact.
Look, it's not surprising in the sense that CAA is very, very aggressive about signing people and taking people away. And I think that there are a lot of people at ESPN who heard some of the salary increases that CA had gotten for people, particularly like Sage Steele and others. And they were like, wait a second, hold on. Okay, sign me up for some of that.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to invite you back and we'll discuss the Fox Sports 1 strategy and why that might not work. I have my own thoughts. I've certainly said them on this podcast, but that's an hour discussion just on that. This is the powerhouse discussion. So we will bring you back for that. But finally, Jim, one last media question, because this is another guy that you are tight with and have written about and studied, and that is Bill Simmons.
I've heard of him.
Yeah, I don't want to really ask about the HBO show because so much has been written about that already. And quite frankly, like whatever that show becomes, you have to see come NFL season 10, 11, 15, 20 episodes in. But I am interested in The Ringer because the podcast that we did on Grantland, one of the most trafficked podcasts that I had done at that time with you, right when Grantland went down. And now we're into Bill Simmons's second act in terms of being fronting a website. And The Ringer is interesting to me. While there's certainly talent there, and I'm rooting for their success, if you're going to be honest, it has absolutely not had the impact that Grantland has had, and it even hasn't sort of had that, you know, that one or two breakout stories that everybody in the sports media is talking about. I don't know what the numbers are, and again, it's still early in that website, and they're going to keep building. Their podcast division is great. They're going to add video people. But what have been your initial thoughts with The Ringer? Is it what you expected it to be when Simmons first announced that this was going to be his digital home?
Well, I guess, you know, my first response was, I think that we've come to a point in time now where it's not like Bill Simmons left ESPN and then he went and did the same thing with Turner Sports or NBC or Fox or something. The real judo move that has kind of caught me, you know, kept me awake thinking about is, here's a guy with, you know, a distinctive intellectual property, and he now is able to go out and create his own kind of distribution network in his own world. So it's not, I mean, that's a thing that we all have to pay attention to, right? Because it's no longer just about these big media companies that are able to deliver content. In fact, when you think about Simmons' podcast, for instance, when he was at ESPN, ESPN, I think, had a rough time. I don't think they really understood, or they had a rough time selling it at the numbers that he thought they should be selling it. Now he's got his own kind of financial network for that podcast, and it's doing really well. And by the way, he's probably making, you know, a ton more on the podcast than he was at ESPN. Right. So first and foremost, it's just the structure of it all, right? You don't need to just be with one of those big players. More specifically to your answer, I don't know. I mean, there are people over at The Ringer. I mean, Sean Fennessy, people like that are wickedly smart and really capable. I wouldn't bet against them. And I think that, you know, Grantland had obviously Simmons, but it also was launched from ESPN. So you had a lot more eyeballs and you had a bigger cannon from which you were being fired, you know, from. But I think that what you say parenthetically and your question is probably right, which is it's too soon to tell. But I really believe that they have enormous plans over there, to, like, as we used to say in business school, vertically integrate. And they're going to be getting into video and they're going to be doing shows. And, so it'll be very, very interesting to watch. I just love the idea that, you know, they're kind of doing it on their own. And, while they may have some investors with, you know, in terms of HBO and some of the buildings and all that stuff, they're still kind of master of their domain, which is a pretty cool thing to be.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm rooting for them to succeed. I think their podcast network's been awesome. And again, I've always said this about Simmons. He took his fame and created well-paying jobs for others. That's an incredible thing in the sports media. Very few people have done it. Peter King, Adrian Wojnarowski, et cetera. But it's a very, very short list. And even if you don't like him personally, I can't see how you wouldn't root for a startup like that to succeed. So we'll be paying attention to that.
You and I already went over this on that pod that you referred to, but I do think even still this many months later from when we discussed it, I still think that it's unfortunate that the demise of Grantland happened the way it did. And I think that, I think that there were numerous ways in which that could have been avoided, but, a lot of people worked really, really hard on it. And I think that it had a very, very, dramatic history for something that wasn't alive that long. And I hope that my biggest thing about Grantland is that the people who work there, find their way to meaningful jobs elsewhere, either at the Ringer or other places, because I think a lot of the work there was excellent.
Well, that's happened. I mean, Zach Lowe put himself in an incredible position to be to have multiple suitors, including ESPN and Bleacher Report after him, Bill Barnwell re-signing with ESPN. So and then obviously Bill Simmons has taken a lot of former Grantland staffers who are now back at the Ringer. So, again, that guy helped launch multiple careers, and I think that's happening. Generally speaking, Jim, I think most of the people at Grantland have found homes elsewhere, including a couple at SI, Andrew Sharp, et cetera. So that's the one thing Simmons provided. He gave people a forum to not only succeed at Grantland, but to continue on in careers in media. Is there anything else, Jim, that we need to discuss today before you move on to your many other media responsibilities?
Oh, my God. I think there was one thing that came out of the reporting for Powerhouse, which, you might find of interest, which was that in 2015, for the first time in CA's 41-year history, sports was the dominant revenue generator.
Wow.
In fact, CA Sports wasn't launched until 2006. So when you think about a Hollywood entertainment agency, you have this tendency to think, particularly a place that has like Tom Cruise movies and Jurassic Park franchises and Game of Thrones and ER and all these, there are trailing revenues of all those other projects. But now, 2015, last year, sports was the number one revenue producer. And I think that, for your audience, and I think, it's just interesting to think about the fact that even though we sometimes have a tendency to shorthand sports with the entertainment agencies, it's just some agent representing some athlete or an announcer, for ESPN or some other place. There's a ton of money that's in the sports world now out there for media rights and consulting and all these other sponsorships of, they did Levi Stadium and they did Yankee Stadium and they did a deal with the Dodgers. And the money is really significant. So I just was, kind of being a sports media freak, I just was blown away by the fact that sports had become number one inside the building.
Yeah, pretty impressive. And the New York Post not too long ago did a 2-page kind of look at Jim's book where they really focused heavily on sports.
Oh, that was the Times. Yeah,
Times. Yeah. I'm sorry. New York Times did. My bad. I think the Post actually did something too, but maybe that was more entertainment based. All right. So the book is Powerhouse by Jim Miller. Go Google it. Check it out. Go buy it. It's 700 plus pages, but because it's the oral history format, it's very, very readable. And I highly recommend it. All right, Jim, listen, again, you're a busy man. You're doing very high profile media appearances. So I appreciate very much that you have come to join Alan Kim and I on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
So funny. Listen, in all seriousness, thanks for having me.
Of course. Jim Miller, everybody. All right, my thanks to Jim Miller. We'll have him back, of course, to do some straight media talk, but wanted to give you a little bit of ESPN stuff in addition to Jim's book, Powerhouse. Jim's been a good friend, so I'm totally rooting for his book to succeed. My thanks to Alan Kim. Thanks to all the people putting these podcasts together, from Dan Bloom, John Wertheim, Chris Stone, Bette Marston, my other producer, very busy during the doing the Olympics, Ryan Hunt, Ben Eagle, of course. Got to mention him. He's in Rio right now. Some upcoming podcasts will be Andy Roddick. Looking forward to him. And then the last couple, Lisa Fenn, Terry McDonnell, and Otto Bolton and Rowdy Gaines, the NBC Olympic analyst. And we'll have some pretty good guests coming up. Thanks, as always, for listening to this podcast. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.